The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here today with IJ Senior Attorney Bob McNamara and IJ Attorney Josh Windham. As the coronavirus pandemic drags on, Americans are spending a lot of time close to home. That makes the case that we're going to dive into today especially relevant. It has to do with the circumstances under which government agents can come onto private property and what they can do when they're there. Josh, you're representing two men in Tennessee who've had to deal with some pretty extraordinary examples of intrusion by local government. Could you talk about what they've experienced?
Absolutely. So this case is about whether the government can enter your property, wander around, and install surveillance cameras in your trees to watch you 24/7. Our clients are two rural private property owners in Tennessee, each of whom own dozens and dozens of acres of land, one of whom lives on the land with their son, the other of whom, you know, uses the land for recreation, hunting, farming, that kind of stuff. Both of them have experienced unwanted intrusions by Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency officers. The officers have been wandering around their properties without a warrant or their consent. They've been recording video footage of the properties, and they've even been installing cameras in their trees to watch them 24/7. This case is about trying to put a stop to those practices.
Is it pretty clear that the property is private property? It's not just an accident that the officials are wandering around there?
It's not only clear. I mean, there are gates up and no trespassing signs and all of that. But the officers involved in this case actually knew about the owner's use of their property. And in Terry's case, one of our clients' residency on the property. So the agency was fully aware that this was private property used and sometimes lived on by private property owners.
So when they're putting cameras up, What all they can they see? As I recall, they even cut some branches away to make sure that they have a really clear view. What are they looking for? What are they looking at with these cameras?
So one of our property owner clients' name is Hunter, and there the officers, where the camera was positioned, they could actually see people entering and leaving the property. And after they had installed it, the camera had taken several photos of TWRA officers entering and leaving Hunter's property, often when he was not there, just to snoop around. For Terry, our other client, he lives on the property, and he also has a tenant on the property. And the camera was actually facing the back of his tenant's home, just kind of watching it 24/7.
Why? I mean, if the property owners went to the agents here and said, like, what are you looking for? What was the response, or what would the response have been?
I mean, I think the rationale here is that TWRA is trying to monitor for potential hunting violations. At the time the cameras were installed, both Terry and Hunter had hunting licenses and were legally hunting on their properties. And so TWRA wanted to monitor them for potential violations. That's the rationale for installing the cameras. And, you know, what they were doing here, to be clear, was investigation. They were looking for evidence of a crime.
So it seems like people sneaking onto your property and putting cameras, especially if those people are from the government, just, I think most Americans would say, it seems like that's something that you're not allowed to do. How on earth could these people think it was okay to do that, to come in and put cameras and snoop around like that?
Well, the traditional way you would investigate crime, right, is you would build up probable cause to think a crime had been committed, and then you would go to a judge and seek a warrant based on probable cause to go search the property. But, you know, under federal law, federal courts interpreting the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, for about a century now, there's been a doctrine called the Open Fields Doctrine, which says, in short, that officers don't have to obtain a warrant to search privately owned property outside the home and what's called the curtilage, which is kind of just the area surrounding the home, like your yard or maybe a shed that's located, you know, a few hundred or dozen yards away. But, you know, open fields or forests or other kind of rural land that you own, that's not protected by the Fourth Amendment, or at least according to federal courts today.
And so these Tennessee officers, they're looking to that as the justification for, okay, we can do whatever we want as long as it's far enough away from the house?
Exactly right. They're relying on the open fields doctrine.
How much of the our client's property would qualify as open fields here? If they have, you know, so many acres of land, what percentage of it roughly is then under this doctrine open to, you know, the whims of the officials who decide to stroll around and look for stuff?
It's about 99% of their property in both cases. So really, you're just looking at, if you kind of looked at a map, it would just be the dot that is Terry's home and the yard surrounding the home. And the rest of the property, the rest of the 135 acres of his 136, is entitled to no Fourth Amendment protection. But this case is not filed under the Fourth Amendment. It's filed under the Tennessee Constitution, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit later.
Yeah. So, Bob, can you talk a little bit more about the federal constitution and the court's interpretation of the federal constitution and sort of how we got there? Because I think that this is something that would strike most people as just crazy, because we all think the government needs a warrant to come on our property. We think that when you put up a fence with a no trespassing sign, that should mean something. What happened?
So the idea of the open fields doctrine dates back to a 1924 U.S. Supreme Court decision called Hester v. United States. And Mr. Hester was a moonshiner. He was making uncustomed liquor, which apparently the officers in the case testified that they could just identify by sight uncustomed liquor, as one does. And he complained to the Supreme Court that, he and his partner were kind of running away, and they threw their bottles away, and they were being chased through the land, and it was not the government's land. It was private land. And the Supreme Court just says, in a very short opinion, just look, it doesn't matter if the officers were trespassing. The Fourth Amendment protects your home. It doesn't protect your land. And they were just on your land. And then in the 1980s, that's sort of the initial pronouncement in 1924. In the 1980s, in a case called Oliver, people brought the question back to the Supreme Court, and they said, look, your Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is about the expectation of privacy. And this was private land. We had no trespassing signs up. We had fences. We had every expectation that no one would come see this. And in that case, they were growing marijuana, which the court charmingly spells with an H. And the court said, no. What the Fourth Amendment protects is an expectation of privacy that society is prepared to deem reasonable. And it doesn't matter how many signs you put up. It doesn't matter how many fences you put up. It doesn't matter whether you expect your property to be private. Somebody could see it from an airplane, which tells us that society doesn't expect it to be reasonable. And that really establishes the modern doctrine, which tells us the Fourth Amendment protects your car, it protects your house, it protects a certain area around your house. But once you get away from your house, all bets are off. The Fourth Amendment just has no application kind of on any private property that you have not enclosed in a structure.
So that's the 80s. Is that the latest word on the issue, or has anything come out from the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, more recently?
So interesting things have been happening. The Supreme Court used to ground its Fourth Amendment jurisprudence on this idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy. And that's what you see in the Oliver case, the court just saying, well, it's not reasonable to expect things to be private. But of course, the Fourth Amendment says we should be secure in our houses, our papers, our effects. The Fourth Amendment is about protecting private property from government intrusion. And the court in modern times has started to specifically ground its Fourth Amendment jurisprudence in property law, in the idea that, like, what matters is, did the government interfere with your stuff? Did they have to come touch your stuff? Did they have to come onto your property or into your property? And as the modern court talks more and more about grounding the Fourth Amendment in private property law, the open fields doctrine really starts to stand in stark relief, because that is exactly what these cases rejected. When the Supreme Court said the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to open fields, it expressly said property law has nothing to do with the Fourth Amendment. It doesn't matter that it's your land. It doesn't matter that it is that it has a no trespassing sign or that it has a fence. All that matters is that it's an open field, and that means it's a Fourth Amendment free zone. But in modern cases, where several justices have expressed a willingness to go back to the foundations of the Fourth Amendment and really say the Fourth Amendment is about property, those are in stark tension with the whole idea of the open fields doctrine. Because the Fourth Amendment, even though in most constitutional litigation, the Fourth Amendment comes up in motions to suppress, in sort of lawyers' attempts to get evidence thrown out of court, the Fourth Amendment is not primarily designed as a way to protect criminals from having evidence introduce them in court. The Fourth Amendment is designed to protect us all from having a bunch of dudes in our house, a bunch of dudes going through our mail, a bunch of dudes roaming through our property. And I think we see in our Tennessee case exactly the problem with the open fields doctrine, which is like the whole point to owning land is if you're out hunting on your land and you see somebody roaming around, you can say, hey, this is my land. I don't want you roaming around here. It's dangerous. My brother and I are walking around with rifles. You shouldn't be wandering around. And paradoxically, what the Supreme Court has said is if those random guys walking around your land are from the government, you can't tell them to leave. And it raises the question of what does it mean to own land in the first place? And so there's a real tension there, but it's one the Supreme Court itself has just kind of cast aside. It continues to rely on the open field doctrine as if it is just sort of handed down from above, that that's just part and parcel of modern Fourth Amendment law. And the court has never really grappled with this stark tension between its modern openness to talking about property rights and the fact that in all the open fields cases, it says the Fourth Amendment isn't about property at all. The Fourth Amendment is just about sort of what society thinks is reasonable instead of what's yours and what's mine.
It's really interesting to think about the way that looking at it, you know, as a property rights issue versus a privacy issue could play out in specific instances. And sometimes you get to the same place, sometimes you get to different places. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think a lot of IJ's approach here is that we think the Fourth Amendment is about property. The Fourth Amendment says nothing about crimes. The Fourth Amendment, it comes up in criminal procedure, but it's not about criminal law. It's about being secure in our property. And so IJ has consistently advocated for a property-oriented approach to the Fourth Amendment. I always think of it as, you know, at IJ, we do a lot of litigation about forfeiture and about eminent domain, and those are cases about what property is, about whether I get to keep what is mine. And Fourth Amendment cases are cases about why property is. They're cases about whether I can keep people from coming into my house, whether I can have solitude on my land. That's why we own property in the first place, and that's what the Fourth Amendment is meant to protect. And it can be confusing in sort of the court's modern jurisprudence. And I think I mentioned when I was talking about the Oliver case, the Oliver court said, well, this isn't private because people can see your land when they're flying over in an airplane. And so that's not a reasonable expectation of privacy. And whether that's true or not, I don't really know where I go to measure what society deems reasonable. It's also true that flying over your land doesn't violate your property rights, but coming onto your land and wandering around does. And so there are certainly cases like both approaches would tell us that your rights aren't violated if somebody looks out the window when they're legally flying over your land in an airplane. Where we differ is in whether you can exercise any control over your land at all.
So Josh, it makes it sound like there's a lot of work to be done on the federal side with under the U.S. Constitution, but you alluded earlier to the idea that maybe things were different or better in Tennessee and maybe some of the states. Could you talk a little bit about that and how it plays out in this case?
They are better in Tennessee. I mean, one of the things that Bob alluded to earlier is that the Fourth Amendment refers to persons, houses, papers, and effects. And the Tennessee Constitution doesn't use the word effects. It uses the word possession, which is a different word according to the Tennessee courts. The Tennessee Supreme Court has held since actually the same year as the Hester decision that the word possessions includes land that you use. And both of our clients use their property. And in fact, as I said earlier, TWRA knew they were using their property, and yet they entered anyways. So our position and the Tennessee jurisprudence is pretty clear that the government can't just enter your property and wander around without a warrant looking for evidence of a crime.
So what specific kinds of arguments is IJ making in this case? They're all like exclusively under the Tennessee law and the Tennessee Constitution, or are we trying to draw in some federal points to push that in a different direction? Or?
Well, this is a purely state constitutional argument. We're arguing that TWRA officers not only entered the property without a warrant, but that by doing that, they effected a search, in fact, several searches of the property, because they entered several times over the course of not just one day, but multiple days. And they effected searches when they put cameras in the trees and watched our clients 24/7. And we're also arguing that they seized some of the property when they cut the branches down to put the cameras in the trees. These are state constitutional arguments under the state constitution. But I think the overarching goal here is to add Tennessee to the list of states that have rejected the federal open fields doctrine under their state constitutions, to build a sort of critical mass of states that have said, look, this doctrine is not for us. And not only that, it has serious kind of policy and rationality problems. And hopefully one day the U.S. Supreme Court will reconsider the open fields doctrine under the federal constitution.
So if I were a resident of Tennessee, I would be very grateful to have the extra protections. Is Tennessee unique, or are there other states? You mentioned earlier that some have interpreted their constitutions the way we're hoping that Tennessee will sort of affirm in this case. How widespread are those kinds of provisions in other states?
I don't actually have an exact number, but Alabama, Connecticut, Ohio, Kentucky, Texas, Pennsylvania, Maine, Michigan. There's a ton of states that have this possession word instead of effects in their state constitutions. To my knowledge, there's about 6 or 7 states whose Supreme Courts or high courts have rejected the open fields doctrine to follow a more state-specific and more rigorous approach.
And so for Hunter, for Terry, the clients in this case, what happens if we win? How do things change for them?
I mean, I think the major benefit is that, so we're actually challenging a state statute that enables the wildlife officers to enter our clients' properties. And if we win this case, that statute will be declared unconstitutional and it won't be allowed to be enforced against our clients. So that's kind of the main practical effect, is that, you know, they'll no longer have to be worried that there's somebody hiding behind the bushes while they're hunting, or somebody, you know, installing a camera and watching the back of their house while they sleep. That's not an anxiety they'll have to deal with anymore. And, you know, their enjoyment of their property as people who deserve and expect solitude on their land will increase, right? Because that's what you expect when you get property for yourself, and that's what you deserve.
So, Bob, to just kind of wrap things up, Josh mentioned that we hope that a victory in this case and the ruling of the Tennessee court will have an influence on the federal courts. Can you talk a little bit about how that works, you know, the interplay between the federal constitution and the state constitutions, and how you can urge one to have stronger protections by using the other?
Sure. So it's actually a strategy that IJ employs a lot, but it's a difficult situation when you're faced with a precedent that, as Josh said, is almost 100 years old that you think is not sufficiently rights protective. Because if you go to the court and you just say, you guys got it wrong, you guys should change your minds, the court's going to say, no, we don't want to reconsider our precedents. We don't know what the world would look like if we changed the law, and we should stick with this law that we announced 100 years ago, even if we didn't really think it through 100 years ago. And even if it's not really theoretically sound, it's been the law for 100 years. And it's incredibly powerful in those situations to be able to say, this isn't the only rule you guys could have. In fact, a bunch of states have adopted different rules. They've looked at your reasoning and they've said that your reasoning is bad. It doesn't work for them, and they're going to adopt a different rule. And the sky has not fallen. So you don't need to go off on a wild lark and change 100 years of law with no idea what's going to happen. All you have to do is adopt the majority rule. 30 states have a different rule from the rule you've announced, and life is pretty okay there. And that makes it safer for you to reconsider your precedent, to go with the majority of American law. And that is in many ways what state constitutions are for, is to provide greater protection for individual liberty and show us a lived experience of what greater protection for individual liberty actually means for us in practice. And so the more courts we can get to line up with our vision of how the law should work, the better chance we have of persuading yet more courts and eventually persuading federal courts that our vision is not just workable, but correct. And you only can do that really with practical examples. And so if what you want is to ensure greater protection for private property by eliminating the open fields doctrine, you could just go to federal court year after year and bang your head against the wall hearing no, or you could file cases you could win. And when you win enough of them, it turns out that when you go back to federal court and bang your head, the wall gets a little softer.
Well, good luck in Tennessee, Josh, and thank you both for talking about this case and about the issue. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. If there's an IJ issue you'd like to learn more about, please email me at melanie@ij.org, and we may feature it on a future show.